Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. Since we were last together a couple weeks ago, the 19th Conference of Parties, COP19, was called to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the UNFCCC, ended its sessions without much progress, as you probably know. This time they were held in Warsaw. Next time they'll be in Paris. And thousands of negotiators from the body's 198 member countries flew to Warsaw and took place, as well as lots of non-governmental organizations and the media. And for the first time, official corporate sponsorship was part of this United Nations conference on the climate change crisis. So my reading of why they could take that step and get their logos on the tote bags and be contributing money to the operating expenses, and then given, you know, such a welcome seat at the table, is that there's been insufficient attention to the way they have been interfering with and derailing this process ever since the beginning, the first conference with the Kyoto Protocols. And at that conference, it wasn't covered at all in the mainstream media, but I heard from many people I knew who went as part of NGOs that the planes landing just kept disgorging scores and scores of corporate lobbyists from the fossil fuel industries. And there were several of them assigned to each official delegate from the so-called third world countries. And they just leaned on them to say, don't sign this thing, don't sign this thing. It's your turn. They're just trying to keep you from getting rich. They've had their turn. They've got really big and rich and expanded, and now it's your turn to do that, and they're just trying to keep you from doing that. So, unfortunately, the countries who were being lobbied did not hear proposals that would have given them another option. They felt they were protecting their interests. But, of course, there could have been strong proposals saying, we're only going to sign this if you're going to give us a lot of technology transfer assistance. We want solar panels on all the rooftops in our, you know, very warm, sunny countries. We want assistance doing this, that, and the other thing. But that wasn't pushed for. It wasn't brought together as a proposal. And in the following conferences that happened over and over again, there was this massive army of corporate lobbyists from the fossil fuel industry. And after that first round of, oh, don't sign because it's your turn to get rich, things shifted a little bit. Oh, don't sign because this or that. At this last one, it was, oh, don't sign because they're supposed to pay you reparations. They got that in a little while ago, knowing it would be fully impossible. The northern countries are in economic crisis still, right, from the economic crash in 2008. So, yeah, just go for a lot of money from the north. Don't sign till they give you big piles of money. Again, not the solar panels, not technology transfer. So the people being lobbied, the delegates from all these countries, are very intelligent people with very fancy degrees, a lot of them. They're not at all stupid. And it just makes me wonder, I'm just putting it out there, just wondering if the fossil fuel folks aren't spreading incentives around because just persuasion and friendly arm twisting, I really don't think would do it by this point. So what are they getting in return? What's been sort of dangled as, you know, if you think this is a reasonable position to take that we're talking about, we'll do this, that, and that. So I think this is a huge story. And not only is it not in the mainstream media to the extent it should be, but it really needs to be pulled together in a book. So if anybody listening knows an ambitious young investigative reporter, this is a big story of how they've gotten in there and disrupted this process ever since the Kyoto Protocols. And now, as I say, they're welcomed in as corporate sponsors when, you know, back in so many countries, they're doing everything they can to stop any progress on really addressing the issue, like the Heartland Institute in the United States. So to help things along, there's a transnational institute in Europe called Corporate Europe Observatory, and they put together a report before the conference in Warsaw entitled The COP19 Guide to Corporate Lobbying. And that's still available free on their website as a PDF download. Their website is corporateeurope.org. So that would be one big source of information for someone trying to pull this together and really make the expose that we need to have happen. Okay, turning to our topic for today. Well, as regular listeners know, I'm hugely interested in dynamic interrelatedness. And there have been so many surprising discoveries of this in the past 5 or 6 years, a lot of them in human physiology. I drew them together, all these new discoveries, in a book in 2011 called Relational Reality. And then I got this invitation from PRN out of the blue after I was interviewed to do a radio program. And so I thought, oh, good, I want to keep learning about this emergent understanding of dynamic interrelatedness, which has been going on haltingly in various fields for a few decades, but it's really moving into the mainstream now because the new discoveries are very concrete, very accessible. So our guest today is someone who is himself an expert in this field. He's been studying systemic thinking, another way to talk about dynamic interrelatedness, for decades, written several books. And now he's written one that illuminates the fact that Leonardo da Vinci was indeed a systemic thinker, extremely interested in the dynamic interrelatedness of the physical world, including us. So my guest today is Fritjof Capra. He holds a PhD in physics and is also a systems theorist and is a founding director of the Center for Ecoliteracy, which is located in Berkeley. Fritjof Capra's name is probably associated in the minds of most of my listeners with an international bestseller he wrote in the 1970s. He then immersed himself in systems theory and ecological thought and wrote 4 more influential books after The Tao of Physics. And those 4 subsequent books were The Turning Point, Uncommon Wisdom, The Web of Life, and The Hidden Connections. In recent decades, he's become very interested in Leonardo da Vinci, which resulted in his writing a book entitled The Science of Leonardo. He was a guest on this program about 1.5 years ago, speaking with us about that book, and I've asked him back today because he has a new book out entitled Learning from Leonardo, and the subtitle is Decoding the Notebooks of a Genius. Fritjof Capra, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Charlene, for having me on again. It's a great pleasure.
Well, this book is terrific, I
must
say.
Oh, thank you.
I loved it, of course, because it's aesthetically beautiful. Once again, even with the financial crunch going on in publishing, you managed to convince a publisher to pull out the stops and spend some money and put beautiful plates and illustrations in.
I was very lucky with that.
Yeah. I guess you know, point out that the Leonardo is worth it, and somehow you make the case.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I think just opening the book is great because what they call the end papers, you know, before the actual text begins, is, you know, 2 big pages from his notebooks, and it goes with the subtitle Decoding the Notebooks of a Genius, because, of course, looking at these pages, you don't understand anything. It's all written from right to left in mirror writing, and I have decoded it.
Wow. Well, another feature of the book that I think is extremely interesting in the beginning is the timeline you have of discoveries that Leonardo made in a 30-year period. Between 1485 and 1515, in a in all these different fields. I kept turning the page, and the timeline went on and on. And so I counted them, 45 discoveries
that
were then made 200 or 300 years later by someone who's credited by the history of sciences as having made the discovery, but Leonardo made it during that period, the 30-year period I just stated. So these basic discoveries, sort of the beginnings of fields, he made in optics, acoustics, fluid dynamics, geology, botany, mechanics, aerodynamics, human anatomy, and ecology. So it's just astounding to see it pulled together that way. And I think what I'd like to do to lead the listeners through is to follow this progression.
Okay.
We'll just get to the first couple of these before the break, but I'd like you to tell us first about Leonardo as a systemic thinker. He's been, as you point out, interpreted by historians of scientists and other scientists, actually, as being a mechanistic thinker because he had some mechanical drawings, but they were looking at it through our cultural lens of mechanistic worldview. And so when you bring to it the possibility of seeing it systemically, you realize he's a soulmate, but he's more than a soulmate. He's a towering
exactly.
figure who, you know, had such deep insights into the dynamic interrelatedness
yeah.
of reality. So,
right.
so the first part, maybe tell us why you think he's a systemic thinker, and then the qualities of his genius I thought were quite interesting. And then we'll start into his actual discoveries and explorations in these five or six areas.
Okay.
And at the end, what I want to come to is why the notebooks got so dispersed all over Europe.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I realize you explained to people how they're reunited digitally now
yeah.
on the site with the Leonardo Library. And the very last one, which just burned in my mind throughout reading the book, of why he never wrote the formal cohesive treatise in each of these five or six
right.
areas that would have
right.
established this.
Wow.
That's heartbreaking for the history of Western thought.
Right.
Anyway, okay, so why do you see him as a systemic thinker?
Program.
Sorry?
Well, Leonardo as a systemic thinker, this was actually what drew me to him from the very beginning. I saw a big exhibition of his drawings in London in the mid-90s, and I realized going through these halls with drawing after drawing that his science really has to be understood as a science of patterns, a science
mm-hmm.
of relationships. He constantly, very often on the same sheet, would draw a picture of, you know, a human skeleton and a picture of the, so to speak, skeleton of a cathedral or a cupola or some
mm-hmm.
architectural form.
Mm-hmm.
He would draw plants, and one of them I have in one of the tables, plants that spiral, their foliage spirals in a way that it almost looks like a water vortex. And so he constantly drew these parallels, and I saw this in his drawings in the mid-90s, and then when I actually got to reading his notebooks about only 10 years later, I realized that's actually very much true, that for Leonardo to solve a problem always meant relating it to other problems.
Mm.
And so, for example, when he studied the flow of blood in the human body, he compared it to the flow of water on the surface of the earth. As the water nourishes the plants in the landscape, so the blood nourishes the tissues of the body. And so the sap in a plant nourishes the plant tissues. So he went from geology to anatomy to botany, and when he made progress in one area, he would revisit the other areas and change his ideas accordingly.
Huh.
And this could be seen actually only very recently, since about the 1970s, because one difficulty scholars throughout the centuries had with Leonardo's manuscripts was that he didn't date anything. And so it was very difficult when people like Richter, for instance, has a very famous selection of the writings of Leonardo, classical book from the 19th century in Germany. And he orders various quotations and excerpts according to subject matter. And so you have lots of passages that are contradictory. And people would say, well, that's not really science. Look, he contradicts himself all the time. But those were written, you know, 20 years apart or 30 years apart. Mm-hmm. And when you actually date them, and this was done, you know, by a lot of scholarship. So when you see the dated material, you can follow his thought in sort of in a spiral where he goes round and round, visiting and revisiting subjects and making progress and going up sort of in a helical path.
Uh-huh.
So this is how my initial hunch that he really is a systemic thinker was confirmed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then he brought several qualities of mind to this lifelong project you identify as qualities of genius.
Yes, I was fascinated by finding out what made Leonardo a genius. How did he become a genius? And I couldn't. There's no answer to this question. Mm-hmm. And I read, I think, two or three books by psychologists and one by a geneticist about the nature of genius. And so we know today that there are certain characteristics, certain mental characteristics or qualities that are typical of geniuses, whether it's, you know, the German poet Goethe or Shakespeare or Mozart or Einstein or Leonardo. And those are maybe first and foremost a relentless curiosity. And that's certainly true of Leonardo. He always was curious in exploring things in so many fields.
Mm-hmm.
The other quality is what I call holistic memory, to be able to remember things as a whole, as a gestalt, a pattern.
Mm.
And you probably know this well-known story of Mozart, that as a child he would go and hear a very complex choral work with orchestration and a big choir, and then he would go home and write it down, note by note, you know, the whole thing.
Mm.
And of Newton it is also said that he would work out his papers in his head and often keep them for months without publishing them, and eventually he would write them down.
Mm.
So, and Leonardo was the same. Leonardo, it is said, for instance, that when he painted The Last Supper, he would go around Milan looking for characteristic faces that he would give his apostles.
Mm-hmm.
And he just remembered people. He would spend hours and hours walking through the streets of Milan, and then he would go home to the studio and draw it all, you know, every single face that he saw that was remarkable to him. So
mm-hmm.
he had this kind of holistic memory too. And another quality is the ability for intense concentration over long periods of time. And that was certainly true for him. That was true in his oil paintings. You know, he worked on the Mona Lisa for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was true in his science, in his anatomical dissections, which also took hours and hours. He would spend a whole night dissecting bodies. And this intense concentration is also typical of him.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the other question is, what made him a genius? How did he acquire these qualities? And there's really no answer to that we can think of, because...
Right, because he was barred from attending the university, right?
Right. He grew up on a farm. He was raised by his uncle, Francesco. He had a very good training afterwards as a painter and sculptor and engineer in the studio of Verrocchio.
But the reason he was barred is he was an illegitimate birth, right?
That's so right.
He was barred from university.
He mm-hmm. Therefore, he didn't study Latin or Greek. I mean, he could read some Latin texts later on with the help of friends who were scholars, but that was not his formation.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the other genius is the same. Goethe had an excellent university education, and so had Newton. But Shakespeare had sort of, you know, run-of-the-mill parents, apparently, no special background, and nor did Leonardo. So we don't really know what makes people a genius.
Except Leonardo did grow up in the countryside, and so he was immersed in nature during formative years, and that must have made an impression.
Yes, absolutely. He lived in nature, and from childhood he was drawing plants and insects and animals and showed great talent, and that's why his father, who didn't do much for him, he recommended him to one of the best masters in Florence, and so his father redeemed himself in a way for neglecting the child in the early years.
Mm-hmm. Masters in painting,
Masters in painting, yes.
Yeah.
And he really had a holistic education, because at that time in the 15th century in Florence, these artists learned not only painting, but also sculpture, engineering. And you have to realize that a painter in the 15th century Florence had to make all his colors, his varnishes, prepare the wood and everything. So they had to be sort of practical chemists. And then when they did a sculpture, for instance, for a church and wanted to put it up somewhere, you know, in an alcove or on the altar, or even you know, high up in the Cathedral of Florence, they had to raise it. They had to invent some machines, some lifts to raise the sculpture up. So they had to be excellent engineers. All this, you know, came together in Leonardo's education.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was the seed of his systemic thinking. And another very interesting fact, which is not well known, is that in this workshop, in the bottega, as it was called, in Verrocchio's workshop, all the apprentices had to have journals every day. And in the journals, they would write problems that the master would give them to solve, problems of geometry or problems of engineering, and they would write notes about techniques of oil painting and things like that. And so it was a very mixed, journal that they had every day. And I think Leonardo acquired his habit of writing everything down in thousands and thousands of pages very young as an apprentice.
I see. So you're sort of thinking, it's a record of your thinking about these problems on the paper. So,
yes. Yeah, right. And of course, we don't have any of his, you know, notebooks as an apprentice. I mean, that would be a huge find, you know, if somebody found something like that.
Well, let's move into these areas that he became fascinated with. The first one was the movement of water, right?
Right. And let me also say that scholars have always thought of his notebooks and his whole science as very disordered and chaotic. And it's true that the notebooks are disordered. So some of them have some order in them, but most of them are, you know, just very random almost. But his knowledge was not disordered at all, and he has many reminders to himself in the notebooks how to eventually present his science to the public.
Mm-hmm.
And I have used these reminders to structure my book accordingly. So learning from Leonardo has the kind of structure which I think Leonardo would have liked.
Oh, yes, that was very interesting, because you took all his clues and hints.
Exactly.
Had he made these treatises of the macro level on
right.
the studies at the micro, probably would have been in this order. So, yeah, that was great to be reading it that way.
So, for instance, he writes, you know, before explaining the motion of the body, be sure to put the chapter on elements of mechanics before, so that you can explain, you know, the bones as levers and so on. And so my chapter on mechanics is before the chapter on the body in motion, and it is called Elements of Mechanics, as Leonardo wanted to call it.
Right.
So I took several of his hints there.
Well, again, we'll come to this at the end. It's a little depressing that no one's done this before now. They just looked at it and sort of gave up and said, oh, this is just a hodgepodge, you know, when in fact it would have been possible to follow his clues. But it took, I believe, you know, a systemic orientation to be able to realize his whole overall way of arriving at all this. So,
absolutely.
Let's go into some of his discoveries.
Yeah, I mean, water was the element that fascinated him most throughout his life. And in fact, the leitmotif, the guiding principle of my book, is that Leonardo, at the most fundamental level, was always interested in life. He wanted to find out the nature of life. Life is at the very center of his science.
Mm-hmm.
And so he recognized that water is a crucial element for life. He said water is the carrier of nutrients, and water sustains all organic bodies, all living bodies. And with that, of course, he was completely right, because we know today that water not only evolved in life in the primeval oceans, but also that when the first cells turned into multicellular organisms, every cell still developed and still develops now in a watery environment. So water is really the matrix of life, and that's one thing Leonardo recognized.
Mm-hmm.
And he was especially interested also in water's role and the blood's role in the human body to carry nutrients to the tissues and so on. But there's another reason why he was so interested in water, and that's my personal interpretation. He was very interested in turbulent flows. And when you look at a whirlpool, your basic whirlpool in your bathtub, then you can see that it's a very stable form. You can disturb it, you can play around with it, but it will more or less go back to the original form. And still, water flows through it all the time. So there's a coexistence of stability and change. And that is characteristic of all living systems. All living systems maintain their pattern of organization while continually going through structural changes, you know, recycling components and so on. And I believe that Leonardo intuitively saw that the water vortex is a kind of symbol for life, because it has this coexistence of stability and change. And so he was fascinated in not only vortices, but all kinds of turbulent flow throughout his life.
We have to pause here for the break, but we're going to come back to this in just a few moments.
All right.
So this is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, speaking with my guest, Fritjof Capra, author of a new book, Learning from Leonardo, Decoding the Notebooks of a Genius.
Let's give them something to talk about, babe. A little mystery to figure out.
Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Fritjof Capra, author of Learning from Leonardo, Decoding the Notebooks of a Genius. So I think the way we should use the time here in the second half is to just organize it, explain to readers that it's just in two big sections in your book. It's very easy to follow. One is at the macrocosm level, macrocosmic level.
Right.
Leonardo looked at water, the living earth, the growth of plants, and then at the microcosmic level, related to the human body, he looked at five areas. So could you sort of hit the highlights on those, even though he did so much?
So in the macrocosm-microcosm distinction was, of course, very well known to people in the Renaissance. Ever since antiquity, people made this distinction and drew parallels. So in the macrocosm, he looked at the movements of water. He looked at geology, that he would say he would study the living earth, and that of course also was something very well known in the Renaissance, that the earth is alive ever since the Greek myths about you, about which you have written so much, Charlene, ever since those myths, people thought as the Earth as being alive, and the Earth being a mechanical system. This belief was held only for about 300 years in all of human history, and now we have again the Gaia theory of the living Earth. So it was interesting to me that Leonardo did not say, okay, let's study some geology, but he realized that water was the main force of shaping the surface that shapes the surface of the Earth. So it was his study of water that led him to geology. And in geology, he discovered the nature of rock strata. He understood both erosion that takes place under the force of water and weather, erosion and sedimentation, that is, the processes through which strata were formed. And he understood that this took very, very long periods of time, what we now call geological time. So he was well aware that this was not just a few thousand years, but much, much longer.
Mm-hmm.
He also studied the folding of rock strata, and he had a very interesting theory about what we now call tectonic forces, and I can't go into these details, but I do in the book. But then the interesting thing again is that as he studied rocks eroding and being carried down by rivers and getting smaller and smaller, turning into gravel and eventually fertile soil out of which plants were growing, he connected not only water with rocks, but also the rocks with soil and soil with the life of plants.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, it was all, in the service of life.
Mm-hmm.
And so from geology, he went to botany and studied especially the flow of nutrients. He realized amazingly that sunlight contributed to the growth of plants, and also that the air, there's a very intriguing passage where he says the air nourishes the plants.
Mm.
And this is almost uncanny, because today we know that photosynthesis, takes the carbon out of the air, the carbon dioxide out of the air, and the sun provides the energy.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was especially interested in what we now call these metabolic processes. In studying the growth of trees, he recognized the importance of the annual growth rings. He knew that you could count the age of the tree when you counted the growth rings, but he also realized that the width of a growth ring gives you information about the climate in that particular year. Now, you can imagine that it takes quite a bit of detailed knowledge about how a tree grows to be able to relate the humidity of the climate in 1 year to the width of the growth ring.
Mm.
So again, in botany, by botanists today, he's considered the first theoretical botanist. And I often say in my lectures, when you do a poll, among your listeners and ask them who was Leonardo da Vinci, they will know a lot, but nobody will say he was the first theoretical botanist.
Uh-huh.
And so he did so many things.
Yeah.
Then, of
yeah.
course, that's the macrocosm.
Uh-huh.
So then in the microcosm, he concentrated on the human figure. And as I mentioned before, he studied mechanics in order to understand the movements of the body,
mm-hmm.
the working together of what he called nature's mechanical instruments.
Mm-hmm.
So here an idea that is difficult to understand, as you already mentioned, to most observers, is that Leonardo was a mechanical genius, but his thinking was not mechanistic.
Mm-hmm.
See, he realized that the body needs, or nature, as he says, needs mechanical instruments so that the animal body can move.
Mm-hmm.
But the center of the movement is in the soul. So the body is not a machine. It is animated, and the force of life is the soul. And I found that what Leonardo calls the soul and how he talks about it comes very close to our modern concept of cognition as the basic process of self-organizing systems.
Mm-hmm.
He calls
he has,
the soul.
He has, as you point out, this I think lifelong awe, marveling at the beauty and grace of life.
Yes.
He always has that deeply spiritual, not connected with the organizational church,
yeah.
his own,
yeah.
and I think from that formative time in nature, which is just so amazing. And so that's what's lost, you know. Other Renaissance thinkers later on, as the culture moves farther away from that and more into the hubris of the human, look how smart we are, we can measure things. And, you know, but it, in the early Renaissance, he still, as you point out, has influences from the late medieval holistic world. And so that's
and even
one
from
of the
Aristotle,
tragedies that's lost, that he couldn't put that on paper, because then the culture loses its way a little later.
Yeah, absolutely. No, he had a reverence of nature and a reverence for life. For instance, he once wrote down, those who do not respect life. Those who do not respect life don't deserve it.
Yeah.
No, that's very typical of him.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, in order to understand the movements of the body, he studies mechanics. And interestingly, he says that is the most noble role of the mechanical sciences.
Mm.
Now, if you compare this to Bacon or Galileo, they think mechanics will give you knowledge and knowledge will give you power to dominate nature. Leonardo says mechanics gives you the knowledge about how the animal body moves. And as an engineer, he took nature as a model and as a mentor, something we now call biomimicry or eco-design.
Mm-hmm.
So totally different attitude.
Mm-hmm.
But it is interesting, Charlene, that with all the books that exist, beautiful books about Leonardo's mechanical engineering, there's not a single book about his theoretical mechanics. So it turns out that my chapter on his mechanics, the elements of mechanics, is the longest chapter in the book because he made some amazing discoveries in theoretical mechanics.
Mm.
Let me just give you a very brief list.
Mm-hmm.
The relativity of motion, which was really discovered in the 17th century by Huygens, something which is called Newton's third law, that for every force or every action, there's a reaction, an equal and opposite force.
Mm-hmm.
Leonardo saw that very clearly with many examples, you know, 300 years before Newton. He had an intuitive grasp of the conservation of energy. Also amazing, because the concept of energy really took hundreds of years to be developed.
Mm-hmm.
And even more astonishing, he had a clear grasp of the dissipation of energy. The fact that energy gets always lost, whether you talk about a machine or a living organism, energy always dissipates in all processes. Now, this is now known as the second law of thermodynamics, and we are in the 19th century, mid-19th century. So again, he was way ahead. And, you know, ballistic trajectories, I have to mention. This is a very interesting story, too. At the time of Leonardo, there were many military engineers and philosophers and scientists. So let's say not at his time, but in the 16th and 17th centuries.
Mm-hmm.
And when they drew a ballistic trajectory, they would draw a straight line, and then the cannonball or whatever we are talking about would describe a circle, and then it would fall down vertically. Even Galileo drew that in his earlier work.
Mm-hmm.
Leonardo, from the beginning, drew the parabola, which is the exact curve. And you know how he got that?
Mm.
He realized that when you observe a projectile, you can't really see very well, you know, the trajectory and how it flies. So he observed very simple water coming out of a water hose. And he reasoned that every particle of water is a projectile. And, of course, with a water hose, you can beautifully see the parabola. And so he drew it. And he drew it at several angles and did studies of several parameters and so on. So all this shows an abstraction of thinking, which is absolutely astonishing.
Yeah.
Now, part of mechanics also, of course, was his aerodynamics. And here again... And I have to mention something which has not been recognized before in Leonardo's work, and that is that he uses theoretical models very frequently. And this is something we do in science today all the time. And what I mean is that when you study a phenomenon which is too complex for you to really see what's going on, you make a simpler model. Mm-hmm. And so he would say, I want to study the flow of water, but I can't see the water particles. So I will study the flow of rice. And he took a barrel of rice and dipped it over, and he could see the rice particles, the grains of rice, of course. Mm-hmm. And so he realized that the principle of flow was the same for water and for rice. Mm-hmm. And in this simple model, he could see the flow lines.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he studied aerodynamics to understand the flight of birds, and you know, the construction of his flying machines, he said, I can't see the air, but the air flows the same as water. And so I would use water as a model. He actually didn't say model. He said, very interestingly, he said, I will use the flow of water as a ladder. And that ladder will bring me to the understanding of the flow of air. So again, you know, what I'm fascinated by is the level of abstraction of his thinking and always interconnecting various fields.
Right. I want to move on to the last two, but this last area related to the human, the mystery of life, was very interesting too. He was interested in the embryo, the fetus, the growth of the fetus, and, you know,
and again, you know, when you look at these drawings, these embryological drawings, you know, one of a fetus in the womb and the other one of a calf, the fetus in the calf in the womb of a cow, and you see a tenderness, you see his whole respect for life, you know, in these drawings. They're delicate, you know, they're deeply moving.
Exactly, and that's what I'm getting to. Why I think that's why he painted his famous women that way, because he's fascinated with the ultimate unfolding processes of life and the human, and, you know, it all grows in the female body.
Right.
And it's very interesting the way you decode the background on his famous pictures of the women, the Mona Lisa, the Madonna of the Rocks, and the Madonna with St. Anne, her mother, as well as the infant Jesus. And in the background, he's presenting all his geological research and discoveries. And one of them, you know, the history of the Earth, different stages of formations of rocks or rivers, you know, creating valleys in the background. And then there's this, you know, the female body in the foreground. It just really made sense once
Back. The Earth was female. You know, terra in Italian is just grammatically female and was, of course, always seen as female.
Yeah.
And you know, for a man who was gay, I think also that's quite astonishing, that intimate knowledge of the female body and all the processes.
Yeah. Okay, we just have about 4 minutes, so I want to move into something I'm very interested in here.
Yeah.
I know it's just open history, but I'm not clear on it. When he died, he left these notebooks, you know, bequeathed to someone to have possession of them. What happened such that they ended up dispersed over Europe?
Well, it's a very
sad story. Finally, after you answer that, please give my listeners the website address of the Italian library that now has put them all online with translations.
Yeah. Okay, so the story is a sad story. His favorite disciple, who was with him for most of his life, was a young nobleman from Milan, from Lombardy, called Francesco Melzi. And he became his heir. Leonardo left all the paintings, all the manuscripts to Melzi. Melzi bequeathed the paintings to the King of France, because that's where Leonardo ended his life, and took the manuscripts with him. And in his villa, not far from Milan, he installed a whole floor, a whole suite for the notebooks and various drawings, and showed them to contemporaries and was very proud of that. And then when Melzi died, his son Orazio Melzi was sick and tired of this Leonardo cult that his father had maintained, and he packed everything up into boxes and put them in the attic. And not only that, and that's almost criminal, he let it be known that there are hundreds of drawings of Leonardo da Vinci in his attic, and whoever wanted them was welcome to come. And so they got dispersed, and there was one sculptor called Leone who worked for the King of Spain, who bought most of them and transported them to Spain. So at the end of the 16th century, most of Leonardo's manuscripts were in Spain, about 80% maybe. And then they got dispersed. They were bought by English aristocrats who were interested in the drawings. And, of course, nobody was interested in the text because they couldn't read it. Yeah. And so, you know, Leone, for instance, assembled various drawings in big folders, which is now called the Codex Atlanticus, and cut out the writings that he found uninteresting and threw them away and just kept the drawings.
Oh, my gosh.
And, yeah, so this is why about half of his notebooks are lost now, but we still have 6,000 pages, and our listeners can look at them and can magnify them and everything on this website, which is called eLeo, e-leo, and it is maintained by the Leonardo Library in Vinci. They have a big museum and a library. There are also transcripts, but you have to speak Italian to be able to understand the transcripts. It's not translated.
Okay. Now, we have just about a minute or less, and I want your understanding after all this immersion into why he put off or never wrote a cohesive treatise in, say, 5 or 6 years,
yeah,
because he had 40 books on his walls. He knew that was how knowledge traveled. Why do you think he never did that?
Yeah, well, he was always, my view is that he was always more interested in new work, and you can see him starting treatises. There is a treatise on the flight of birds, which is quite, you know, final. There's a treatise on mechanics, but in the treatise on mechanics, it's called Codex Madrid, you see him laying out things very clearly and then getting sidetracked and getting into new material and just going off on tangents.
Okay.
It's his
curiosity. Well, that's, you know, one quality of a genius, maybe. Just
yes,
a little too curious.
It was also his downfall in a sense.
Anyway, we have to end here, but I want to thank you so much for EF
Well, you're very welcome. It's a great pleasure to talk to you.
Coming on the program, and again, folks, the name of the book, Learning from Leonardo. Okay, well, let's amble over to the Arts Corner. We don't have a Leonardo to gaze at, but we have a poem. And it's selected for those of you who happen to be observing the liturgical season of Advent. This is a poem about the Virgin Mary, because after all, no Mary, no nativity. This poem is by the winner of the National Book Award in Poetry this year, Mary Zibist, and it's from her collected poems entitled Incarnadine. It's about her own lifelong relationship with Mary, and it's entitled Hail. Mary, who mattered to me, gone or asleep among fruits, spilled in ash, in dust, I did not leave you. Even now I can't keep from composing you, limbs and blue cloak and soft hands. I sleep to the sound of your name. I say, there is no Mary except the word Mary, no trace on the dust of my pillow slip. I only dream of your ankles brushed by dark violets, of honeybees above you murmuring into a crown. Antique queen, the night dreams on. Here are the pears I have washed for you. Here are the heavy-winged doves asleep by the hyacinths. Here I am, having bathed carefully in the syllables of your name, in the air and the sea of them, the sharp scent of their sea foam. What is the matter with me? Mary, what word, what dust can I look behind? I carried you a long way into my mirror, believing you would carry me back out. Mary, I am still for you. I am still a numbness for you. And for our song today, well, I certainly hope you didn't miss the divine Miss Piggy last week singing Santa Baby on the Muppets Holiday TV special with Lady Gaga. It was, of course, spectacular, and in case you did miss the divine Miss P, I'm going to play her song for you now. So to set the scene, which you can also see on YouTube, Miss Piggy is wearing a stunning red gown. There's a snowy background, and she's surrounded by 12 handsome men in tuxedos singing backup. That's whom you'll hear her addressing in the middle of the song when she feels they are, as she puts it, singing over the star. She refrains from throwing any karate chops, and all proceeds harmoniously. This is Miss Piggy singing Santa Baby. Here it is.
Wow! I've got a vivid imagination!
Santa Baby, just slip a sable under the tree for me. I've been an awfully good girl, Santa Baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight.
Hurry, hurry down the chimney tonight. Oh.
Santa Baby,
a 54 convertible too,
light blue. I'll wait up for you, dear Santa Baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight.
Hurry, hurry down the chimney tonight.
Oh. Think of all the fun I've missed. Think of all the froggies that I haven't kissed. Christmas is, but do do do, Santa honey,
I want a yacht. And really, I don't think that's asking a lot, do you?
I've been an angel all year,
Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight.
Santa honey, one little thing I really need.
The deed.
I can't believe this. You gotta be kidding me.
Cut.
Stop singing. This is my big number. This is my daydream. All right? Look, you are all very talented, but you never, ever sing over the star. Comprende? Good. Now let's bring this baby home. Together!
Yes.
You hit it!
All right, that was Santa Baby. It was a big hit for Eartha Kitt, but here we heard it by Miss Piggy. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give 'Em Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who my guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespretnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Next week, my co-host, Eleanor LeCain, will be here with her guest, Arjun Makhachani, a nuclear engineer who is author of the book, Carbon-Free and Nuclear-Free, A Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. They'll be discussing an update on the Fukushima nuclear disaster, which, alas, is ongoing, and we'll hear about a pathway to moving beyond both fossil fuels and nuclear energy. I'll be back 2 weeks from today with my guest, Daniel Goleman, talking with us about his new book, Focus. Thanks for joining us. This is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.